are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 13th, 2019. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rutger Bregman, Dutch popular historian and author, on his latest Utopia for Realists. Also on the program today, America shocked. People buy their way into elite universities. Also on the program today, 670,000 people in Puerto Rico have food stamps cut. Meanwhile, Republicans look to do a one-off on that Trump emergency order, and the Trump administration to close international immigration offices across the globe. Is this Boeing 737 failure a function of privatization? And Republicans advance a judicial nominee who blamed date rape on drunk women to a lifetime appointment. Gavin Newsom to impose a moratorium on the death penalty in California. Paul Manafort to impose a greater moratorium on his ability to be a free person. Republicans look to folks to mortgage their retirement. And Dave Rubin had a blog. All this and more on today's program. Yes, folks, welcome to the program. I guess I don't know what happened to me. There are times, like, I'm so used to hearing the opening of the show that I can't hear it. Like, I was literally waiting for...
I was looking at the board like, is there something wrong?
I was waiting for the opening to play. And I just didn't hear it. So apologies, ladies and gentlemen, for my little brain freeze there. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support for its daily operations. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com for just pennies a day. And, of course, also justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, chocolate, coupon code majority, you know the rest. Let's get into this. Last night, I was on Chris Hayes' program with Michelle Goldberg, and we were talking about impeachment. And this coming largely, or at least initially, from an interview that Nancy Pelosi did, and now I can't remember where it was done, but it was a print interview. And she was asked about impeachment. She said, no, I'm not going to even bother. You know, why bother with that guy, et cetera, et cetera. Then she was asked about impeachment again on the Hill. And this is what she had to say.
I just don't believe in it. They wanted me to impeach President Bush for the Iraq War. I didn't believe in it then. I don't believe in it now. It divides the country. Unless there's some conclusive evidence that takes us to that place. Thank you.
Now, let's just for a moment put aside the unless there's some type of conclusive evidence, right? In other words, unless like we have Donald Trump on camera, and I have said this for 2.5 years, he will not be impeached unless there is videotape of him stark naked on the White House lawn chasing around a little boy.
And I think we can all conclude now that that also is not true. he would still not be impeached.
Well, it's conceivable, but and last night Hayes like literally questioned whether there would be, if there was evidence that he had shot a man to death, would the Republicans impeach him? I would say no.
In the middle of Fifth Avenue, perhaps.
Right, indeed, and. So, but putting aside the fact that she said conclusive evidence, which I'm not sure exactly how you get conclusive evidence without any type of investigation short of that scenario. First off, to brag about not impeaching George W. Bush, who not only lied this country into war, not only was involved in the outing of a CIA agent for the sake of maintaining that lie, right? That maintenance of the lie, protecting the fact that there was a lie, is evidence of knowledge that they're lying. That's what a prosecutor would look at. Like, this is the state of mind is proven by the fact they're trying to cover it up. And that's what that was. That was an attempt to cover up the fact that they had lied about the potential for uranium yellow cake to be there. But then, of course, you've got torture. There's a whole nother, in fact, back in the day, I moderated a panel at Town Hall. John Conyers showed up with a book 10 inches thick, maybe a foot thick, of possible impeachment causes. So to brag about that is indicative of the fact that, and then to simply say it's a waste of time, it's divisive. I think there's certainly arguments as to why you would not do this politically, and it's certainly predictable. 2 years ago, I was not just saying that the Republicans wouldn't convict in the Senate in a million years, but that the Democrats would much rather run against a wounded Donald Trump than an impeached one. But the problem with the way that Pelosi is responding to this ignores the fact that impeachment is important. Laying down a marker saying what Donald Trump has done in office, whether it involves the personal enrichment, whether it involves the campaign finance violations. This is all, incidentally, while in office. Whether it involves the fact, I mean, the guy was identified in an indictment as a co-conspirator where his co-conspirator is going to jail in the next couple of weeks for years. So there is no doubt that there has been criminality. Certainly criminality that rises above the idea of lying in a deposition about having sex 4 years into office after the start of an investigation about something that happened 12 years earlier. But forget the tit for tat thing. Donald Trump is in office, at least in part because of the complete lack of accountability that our government held folks like Steve Mnuchin to, but also the Bush administration. Even if there was an attempt to impeach Bush in 2007 and it failed, even if there was a move to look back and provide indictments or a commission to report back on what George Bush did in office and set down a marker, and nothing happened to George Bush, it would have been better for the country. It would have shown that there is some accountability for people who break the law. And I do think that, look, I don't think that the Democrats can impeach or should impeach before the election. And here's why. The most compelling reason in my mind is we all know that they will not get a conviction in the Senate. And I balance this against the notion of accountability, which is why the rhetoric here is so important. But if they impeach Donald Trump in 2019 or in the summer of 2020 and he wins re-election, they will not have a second bite at that apple. And you will have Donald Trump in office for 4 years basically, I think in his mind, to his death or as close as you can get, without the threat of removing him from office, with it gone. So all bets are off. I mean, this is, as I said on Hayes last night, as a metaphor, you need to keep at least a bullet in the chamber. Because otherwise, you're in big, big trouble if he wins re-election. Because he's going to know there's no danger for him whatsoever. But the response by Nancy Pelosi should not be impeachment's a waste of time, impeachment's divisive, impeachment's irrelevant. It should be, we can't impeach because the Republicans are protecting a lawbreaker. And we will hold hearings and we will line up indictments and wait to when it's practical to actually get this conviction, because he is engaged in criminality and he must be held accountable. This is crucial, and it is a huge failure on her part to poo-poo the idea of accountability, which is what she's doing when she poo-poos the idea of impeachment.
Yeah, like, shouldn't that be a selling point for people to vote more Democrats into the Senate, maybe?
Well, I mean, I think from her perspective, I mean, I don't want to argue the politics of it, because I think it could go either way, but it could also be an inducement for people to vote, you know, to vote against the Democrat, to vote against Trump and mobilize Republicans to vote the Senate. And the Senate's going to be very difficult for Democrats to get. So, I mean, I think there is a legitimate argument that Republican voters can be, at this point, motivated by stopping Nancy Pelosi. But you simply say, you know, don't use it as a direct pitch. You simply get the narrative out there that Republicans are protecting lawbreaking. Period. End of story. The practicality of this is the problem. You don't go out if you don't have enough police officers. You don't try and raid a drug cartel and put everybody in danger. And that is where we're at. We know there's a lawbreaker. We know where he lives. We know how to go and arrest him. The problem is the Republicans are sitting there and they have more guns and they're going to prevent us from going in.
That is a very good metaphor. He's basically Pablo Escobar without the Horatio Alger story.
Exactly. And he's also got this whole crew of people who are part of a Republican Party, which breaks down the metaphor a little bit. But folks, unless, of course, you have pipes banging in your apartment, and I'm not going to get into that, there is no need to suffer through another sleepless night, thanks to Calming Comfort by Sharper Image. The luxurious weighted blanket is made with super soft velveteen material and designed with high-density comfort fill to promote a sense of calmness. Plus, by applying an even amount of pressure over your body, Calming Comfort helps the production of serotonin and melatonin and mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged for a restful night's sleep. Hello. I can tell you, what do you mean, hello? What's that supposed to mean? I can tell you, I have one on my bed right now, and when Saul comes in the morning to wake me up earlier than he should, the whole hour ahead thing is really messed everything up in my house. He and I fight for the blanket, because it really does help you sleep, and it's incredibly relaxing. Calming Comfort weighted blanket. I think that's because it mimics the way you were, I think, in the womb. Oh, wow. That's what the one thing they tell you when the kid that's comes out. You swaddle them you wrap them in a blanket, like a papoose for I can't remember how long we did it. Not long enough. Do it for, I don't know, years probably. The Calming Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free, best night's sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. Right now, our listeners can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com and use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout to receive $15 off the displayed price. Again, that's calmingcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY, because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep. CalmingComfortBlanket.com, promo code majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Rucker Bregman will be joining us to talk about Utopia for Realists, to talk about his call for more taxes, taxes, taxes at Davos, and from his moment on Tucker Carlson, which he had to share with us because Tucker Carlson refused to. We'll be right back after this.
Drag my feet along the floor. Then I see you. You're walking across the campus. Cool professor studying romances. How am I supposed to pretend?
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Rutger Bregman, Dutch popular historian and author, publisher of four books. His most recent, Utopia for Realists. Rutger, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you.
Now, first off, I have to ask you for best practices to make sure that you're not recording this on your end.
No, I'm not recording anything, I promise.
Okay, well, that's fine. We're live anyways. So,
yeah, okay.
But I had to do that. We had a lot of we got a lot of enjoyment from your exchange with Tucker Carlson, and I'd like to touch on that in a bit. But first I want to start with your book, which it's fascinating to me for a number of reasons. One, because you were writing about this book was first published in 2017 at a time when I think there was a lot less discussion of things like UBI. And there's been a lot of in many respects, there's been big changes in just the past year or two. Sort of in the realm of what you're talking about, but I want to start with this idea of and in some ways you build in the conservative critique that we hear about people's desire for progress right now when we talk about things like wealth inequality and when we talk about perfecting society in some way, or improving, I guess I should say, which is that we are living in an unparalleled age of stuff and of like throw out some of the parallels you make to like where we are, where your average person is today relative to where they would have been in 1850, for instance.
Exactly. This is important to recognize. We've made extraordinary progress in the past 200 years. Every milestone of civilization that we're used to right now was once a utopian fantasy, right? So whether you think about the end of slavery or democracy or equal rights for men and women, we've made the impossible happen so many times. And that's what progressive politics should be about, you know? Aim high and come up with all those unreasonable, crazy, unrealistic proposals because they may become reality in that way in the future.
And you write that the failure of the welfare state at this point has been to address the symptoms of the discontent rather than the source of the discontent. Expand on that for us.
Sorry, I missed you there.
Okay, yeah, we had a little bit of a hiccup. You wrote,
it's
okay. You wrote that that the failure of the modern welfare state, despite the fact that we have all of these advances when it comes to, fighting poverty, to things like nutrition, things like, advances in terms of wealth and whatnot, that the failure of the current welfare state is that it deals with the symptoms of the discontent rather than the source of it. Expand on that for us.
Yeah. So take poverty, for example.
Oh, you're breaking up.
You'll find out.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Rutger. Can we ring you right back? We're having a little problems with connection.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, we'll call you right back.
All right.
Drag my feet along the floor. Then I see you, you're walking across the campus. Cool professor studying romances. How am I supposed to pretend? I never want to see you again. How am I supposed to pretend? I never want to see you again. Walk to class in front of
It sounds like maybe Rupert Murdoch does have a little bit more power than we could imagine.
Indeed.
Okay, so let me just restate. You've written that the welfare state, despite all the advances, deals with the symptoms of our discontent as opposed to the source of our discontent. Just expand on that and explain what you mean by that.
Sure. Well, if we talk about something like poverty, I think the most important thing we should recognize that poverty is not a lack of character, but just a lack of cash. So in my book, I go over all the evidence we have from economics, from all sorts of experiments that happened since the 70s that show that eradicating poverty by just giving people money, you know, going at the root of the problem and solving it with this medicine called money, works really, really well. But so often what we're doing in practice is that we're, you know, trying to do something about the symptoms, right? We invest in education, you know, all these courses that are supposed to help people make better decisions. That's not really solving the real issue, which is that poverty is just a lack of cash. And in so many cases, we should just hand out the salaries of the people that are trying to help the poor. Because the real experts on the poor's lives are the poor themselves. It's just that they don't have the money.
Let's talk a little bit about the and you give a considerable amount of, at the very least, I mean, data and evidence. Let's talk about what you call Mincom Canada, which I think you know, I think maybe to a certain extent we've talked about a little bit or touched on in on this program. But tell us about the experiment in Canada, and which I don't think most people realize there was also experiments in this country with with simply paying poor people money so they won't be poor.
Yeah, not many people know that at the end of the 60s in the United States, almost everyone believed that some form of guaranteed basic income was going to be implemented. You know, everyone was in favor of it, from the left to the right. There was, at some point, there was a letter in the New York Times signed by 1,000 economists who all said, you know, we got to end poverty in this country. And then in the early 70s, Richard Nixon, of all people, said, you know what, if everyone's in favor of this, let's do it. It's a pretty bizarre history. This bill went through the House of Representatives twice, and it was only killed in the Senate by Democrats, not because they didn't like the idea of eradicating poverty, but because they wanted a higher basic income. So yeah, this is a pretty fascinating history. It was also in this period that in North America, you had as much as 5 big basic income experiments. And indeed, one of them was, as you mentioned, in this small town in Canada, the Mincom experiment.
Well, tell us a little bit about that experiment.
Okay, so this started in 1974. A big experiment, a town where poverty was just completely eradicated. So as soon as you fell below the poverty line, your income would be automatically topped up. Now, there were lots of anthropologists and economists and sociologists who all moved into that town to monitor the effects. And they gathered a lot of data, you know, did a lot of interviews for 4 years. But after 4 years, there was a problem. A new government was voted into power, and they didn't really like the experiment, you know, or the idea of just giving people free money. So what they did is they canceled the whole thing, and there was no money left to analyze the results. So there were 2,000 boxes full of data that had to be put away in the archive, and then basically everyone forgot about it. So 25 years passed until a professor called Evelyn Forget found the records, did the analysis, and found out that actually it was a huge success.
And what, I mean, by huge success, what are the measures that we're using to determine that?
Okay, a couple of things. So in the first place, a lot of people worry that if you would just give people free money, that they'll just stop working. Now, this is simply not true. So in all the experiments, you see hardly any reduction in work hours. And if there's a little bit of a reduction, it is always compensated by people doing more volunteers work, you know, or caring for the children or caring for the elderly. So that's not something to worry about. And then you've got all the other positive effects, like healthcare costs went down. So the hospitalization rate in Dauphin, this town that I was talking about, dropped by as much as 8.5%. Crime went down. Kids doing much better in school. So the interesting thing here, and this is something that researchers actually found from a similar experiment in North Carolina, is that basic income can be an investment that pays for itself in the long run. Because the reductions in healthcare costs and policing costs, et cetera, are bigger than the cash grants themselves. So, yeah, it doesn't really matter if you whether you're left wing or right wing. I always say that if you don't have a heart, then at least you have a wallet. It makes financial sense as well.
I want to touch on in just a moment some of the fascinating history mm-hmm. about Nixon, because that the in addition to the Democrats wanting more, there was another narrative that got developed out of that time inadvertently by mm-hmm. Nixon, you write, and I want to touch on that in a moment. But in terms of the policy itself, to what extent, though, and this has been, to the extent that I've heard any critiques of a UBI from the left, it has been a concern mm-hmm. of the politics that in some way we saw with Dauphin, which is that you could, you know, folks like Milton Friedman wanted to institute a UBI or, you know, a guaranteed basic income. And uh-huh. as a replacement for other forms of support for people living in poverty. And the concern is that if you put all the eggs in that one basket, the ability of that basket to shrink, depending on the political winds, is difficult.
Well, you know, I really see basic income as a directional thought. And there are many, many different versions of basic income. Very exciting and, you know, hopeful. And some of them are just a really bad idea. You know, you have this libertarian version of basic income, which is all about, you know, getting rid of the welfare state as we have it now and just supplanting it with one small cash grant. And don't get me wrong. I think that would be a horrible idea. I mean, I'm from Holland. I know that universal healthcare is a pretty great thing. And public education is also a pretty great thing. So a guaranteed basic income would really be supplement, you know, it would be the crowning achievement of social democracy. So yeah, it's the devil's in the details here. It's important to look at that.
Okay, and so tell us about what Nixon did. I mean, it was fascinating, the idea that he wanted to be the conservative who makes this sort of like a highly progressive leap forward, but in his rhetoric he ended up sort of creating another monster.
Yeah. Well, it's a good example that, you know, if you zoom out a little bit and look at the broader span of history, you just realize that it's really ideas that matter in the long run, right? So it's really hard to imagine right now that in the early 70s, it was this conservative president almost implementing this seemingly radical progressive idea. Now, what happened in that process in the 70s is that it's a pretty bizarre and complicated history. But to summarize it quite quickly, is that Nixon heard something about a report of a sort of basic income issue-like experiment that happened in the early 19th century, actually, in England, where supposedly they had some kind of basic income that didn't work at all. And that sort of convinced him to change his language. So he started to use the language of workfare, you know, as opposed to welfare. And he started talking a lot about the lazy poor and about the lazy, you know, people who are out of a job. And, you know, that was later taken up by Reagan as well. And then we moved into a totally different era. What I've learned from all of this is that history is not governed by big laws, and often it's not governed by, you know, the vested interests either. But coincidences matter a lot, and ideas as well.
So he looks at Speen Hamlin in England.
In England,
and
yeah.
Thinks that workfare is going to be the easiest way to get this guaranteed basic income in, and it ends up all that we get from that is this notion of the premise of workfare, that you need to motivate people to work. Let's talk about your other proposal, and that comes from in part, I guess, maybe the Jetsons, in part from Bertrand Russell, the idea of a 15-hour work week. Explain that to us.
Okay, so this idea, it basically goes back to the famous British economist John Maynard Keynes, right? So in 1930, he wrote an essay called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren. It's a really fascinating read. You can just Google it, Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, and your mind may be blown, because he made two predictions in that essay. It's just 8 pages long, where he said, in the first place, we're going to be a lot richer, right? So if economic growth continues as it has been, you know, as we've seen it since the 1850s, we'll be a lot richer. And if we just use a little bit of that wealth every year to work a little bit less, then the work week will keep shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and we'll be working less and less and less. And if you don't just extrapolate, we'll have a 15-hour work week in 2030. That was Keynes' prediction, one of the great economists of the 20th century. Now, you could say, oh, I never really liked Keynes anyway. He was this crazy guy. But actually, almost all the experts, all the sociologists, the philosophers, up until the 70s, they all believed that we would be working less and less and less. It's only since around the 1980s that we started working in a hell of a lot more.
Well, what happened? I've spoken on this program about finding an article in a steamer trunk at a yard sale from a futurist, I think it was in the early 60s, addressing a Rotary Club in Florida, talking about how we're all going to be carrying around little TVs, which was accurate. Mm-hmm. We're going to get beam stuff from the space. He thought at the time they would be powered by kerosene, but so you can't get everything right. But he did say the biggest challenge we're going to have by the year 2000 is what to do with our leisure time because of the amount of work that we would not need to do. So what happened? I mean, this is what you call, I mean, many respects, I think what you call the great decoupling. But what happened?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. What we underestimate is capitalism's extraordinary amount, or extraordinary ability, I should say, to come up with new bullshit jobs that simply don't need to exist. To be honest, I can already see this, you know, as someone from Holland, where workers are better protected and we've got a higher minimum wage. You see so many jobs in America that just don't exist in Holland, right? Greeters at a supermarket, so much security, that's not really necessary in my mind, right? So capitalism is really good at inventing all these jobs that don't really need to exist. Now, if you don't believe me, you can ask people themselves, right? We've seen huge polls in the past couple of years. There's now a scientific study done by two Dutch economists where they ask people the question, do you think your job adds anything of value to society? Turns out 25% of the modern workforce says, no, I don't add anything of value to society. I could go on strike and no one would care. Now, who are these people? Well, they're not teachers. They're not nurses. They're not care workers. actually, they're often people with wonderful resumes who went to great universities, who work for banks or for consultancies or you name it. But still, at the end of the day, they have this feeling like my job doesn't contribute anything.
Well, so what, I mean, what, why is it in your estimation is that capitalism in the context of the United States develops these you know, bullshit jobs? I mean, I think we had Graber on to talk about this some time back.
But
why do you think it is? I mean, why is, has that been the answer? As opposed to, like, what are the forces that create that dynamic?
Well, I don't think it's about technology or about economics. It's really about ideology. If you have this ideology that goes back to the 19th century, which is all about you have to work for your money, and where we use a very narrow definition of what work actually is. So you have to be in a hierarchical relationship with an employer, and you pay, you know, you get a salary, you pay taxes over that. And that's the only thing we consider work, right? We do not include caring for our kids in GDP. We do not include caring for the elderly in GDP, right? Or all kinds of other volunteers work. Now, if you have this ideology, this belief system about everyone should do this kind of work, and then there's suddenly no work left anymore, right? Because the robots are coming, they're taking more and more jobs. Then you get into this crisis, this ideological crisis, and you just start inventing jobs that don't need to exist. I think that is exactly what we've seen happening in the past couple of decades. And I mean, if you want to see what the future can look like, I think you should go to a country like Japan, because Japan has the most robots per capita, right? It's the most technologically advanced society in the world, probably. But then the unemployment rate is the lowest in the whole rich world as well. So how did it do it? Well, you just walk around in Tokyo for a couple of hours and you'll see so many jobs that don't need to exist, right? There are roadworks and there are literally 10 people standing next to it, waving to, you know, go to the left, go to the right. It's absolutely useless. But that's what happens if you have this ideology that everyone needs to have a job.
Well, so where does, I mean, what is the ideology, is that a function of capitalism? I mean, it's clearly not just puritanical, or maybe it is, and somehow we exported that to Japan. Is it just a function of capitalism, and what does...
No. Communism had it as well, right? So if you went to the Soviet Union, there was also this ideology that everyone should have a job, right? And you would go to... I don't know, a bakery or something, and you would buy a piece of bread, and there would be someone to give it to you, someone to hand you over the receipt, someone to put it in a bag, right? And just because there's this ideology, we all need a job. I think that's what we need to get rid of. The real goal of the future should be, as one science writer once said, the real goal of the future should be full unemployment, so that we can live the good lives, right? That should be the promise of technological progress.
I mean, in some respects, there's a failure of culture too, right? Because there is not enough of a competition for that time. I mean, you mentioned how much people watch TV. I think specifically in this country, and certainly you quote Bertrand Russell. The idea that we don't really, that our leisure time is really just a way to regenerate for work, as opposed to the development of a rich cultural life that makes pursuing things that aren't for work as easy as sort of like almost like second nature as the idea of like entering the workforce.
Yeah, I agree. But here's the interesting thing. If you compare countries internationally and you look at the countries with the longest work week, those are also the countries where people watch the most amount of television, right? Because they worked so hard, and then at the end of the day, the only thing you can do is sit back and watch stupid cable news, right? And be brainwashed. If you look at the countries with much shorter working weeks, you'll see that they're also the countries where people go to the theater most often, where they read the most books, where they do most volunteers work, etc. So my conviction is that if people have the time, they can also, you know, live the good life and actually develop their cultural taste and you name it. But you need the time for it. If you're tired, then the only thing you can do is watch stupid television.
The third goal of the utopia you talk about, and I should just mention, I just have it in my notes here that I did not know, mm-hmm. that utopia is both a what is it a place and oh both a good
it's and a good place no- and nowhere yeah.
and nowhere
yeah
But the third, I guess, leg of this stool is open borders. Why is that important?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is definitely the most radical idea in my book, right? Especially right now. But again, from an historical perspective, it's interesting to note that borders are a quite recent invention. So they hardly existed at the end of the 19th century. Passports didn't exist either. And the countries that did issue them, at some point, like the Ottoman Empire or Russia, they were seen as backwards countries. You know, borders are a relatively recent invention. And the depressing thing is that actually 3/4 of all walls between nations have been built since the year 2000. So sometimes you get the impression that we live in an era of more immigration than ever. But then you're being misled by the news, because in reality, only 2-3% of the world population doesn't live in the country in which they were born. Right. So this is absolutely not an era of massive immigration. It's an era of very, very limited immigration in reality.
But what is the value? I mean, aside from the sort of the tradition, and I imagine maybe there's more, in terms of the scope of history, there's more just a physical ability for mobility at this point, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, mm-hmm. not just we have transportation modes, but we also have a slightly better awareness of where we're supposedly headed to, or what we might see on our way there, right? So it's not like we could fall off the end of the earth, or we're going into, you know, the forbidden zone or whatever it is. I mean, so the idea of, I mean, to a certain extent, there's less sort of like natural obstacles in some ways to migration than there were, you know, 2, 3, 4, certainly, you know, more than that 100 years ago. So, so aside from tradition, though, what is the value to a society, or even does it make sense to refer to a society if we're going to have open borders? I suspect that it does. But what is the value to specifically to our society for that?
Yeah. Well, let me say a couple of things about that. In the first place, we know from a huge amount of evidence from economics that immigration is by far the most powerful tool we have in the fight against global poverty, right? So, we can do a lot of things like development aid, cash transfers, and I'm a fan of all of that. But if someone from sub-Saharan Africa has the ability to move with all his or her talents to a country like America, he or she would be able to make so much more money, right? And then all of the standard objections that people have against immigration, like, oh, they're all criminals, or they're terrorists, or they'll take away our jobs, or they'll drive force wages down, etc. I've taken a look at all those arguments in my book, and it turns out that actually the evidence is very limited for that. For example, when we talk about the issue of crime, immigrants in this country, in the United States, are way less likely to end up in jail or to be convicted of a felony. So that's not the case at all. If you look at, are they taking our jobs? Well, actually, there's a lot of evidence that immigrants bring more dynamism to the economy and actually create a lot of jobs. So, This is, I think, the most important thing here to keep in mind, is that we live in a world of apartheid on just a global scale, basically, right? So 60% of your income is dependent on the simple fact, of which country you were born, yes or no. So I couldn't write a book about a radically better world, or, you know, about utopian crazy ideas that may become reality in the future, and not mention the elephant in the room, right? I had to write something about borders in the nation state.
Fair enough. All right. So, and you make the point at the end of the book that like those folks who gathered at Mont Pelerin in the 40s, They were in the wilderness for about 20 or 30 years, at least, I think, until they were starting to implement their policies. And you don't want to wake up and find that the clock is about to strike 12 and that you haven't, I guess I'm trying to figure out what the metaphor is at that point, gathered your glass slipper and head home or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I mean, but
I mean, it's my job as a writer and as an intellectual to come up with these ideas that may be completely out of touch, but that at least help us to ask the right question. So as a historian, the question that always fascinates me the most is, how will people in the future look back on us, right? Because it's easy for us to look back on the Middle Ages and say, oh, there were barbarians, right? And they had, I don't know, slavery or witch hunts and all these kind of terrible things. But then obviously, people in the future, 2 centuries from now, will consider us barbarians in many ways. Now the question is, what is the most immoral thing we're doing right now? And maybe borders are one of them. Maybe people in the future will look back on this whole system we have of nation states and say, oh my God, that was just, how could they ever justify that?
And so, I mean, if we're looking at this in terms of, because you start off by saying there's been a tremendous amount of progress. You refer to capitalism as providing has opened the gates to a, I think you call it the land of plenty, but it can't sustain it as presently configured. Do you have a sense? And again, and I don't know as a historian necessarily if this is your portfolio, but that one does not need to subjugate capitalism or does need to subjugate capitalism to advance these agendas that you're talking about?
Well, I think that this whole debate in America about capitalism versus socialism is a bit confusing, right? So I believe in markets. Right? I believe in money. I think they can be useful tools to organize our society. But they need to be used alongside many other things like government intervention or the commons, as we call it, just civilians, you know, organizing their own daily business. The thing is, obviously, that the system that we now call capitalism is not working for probably the majority of people in this country. So, yeah. Something definitely needs to change there. But then, I mean, Sweden is a capitalist country. Norway is a capitalist country. I grew up in socialist Holland, and I'm still alive. So I think that the first things that need to be done here in America are just common sense, simple things like universal healthcare for all, public education, universal childcare, you know, all those policies that work really well and are very popular in the countries that try them.
Well, I mean, let me ask you this, because, you know, I was caught up a little bit on your terminology in the end when you talk about the underdog socialists, which I think, you know, to me seem more descriptive of what we refer to sort of like, you know, I guess maybe liberals in this country, I guess, to a certain extent. When you say that that Holland is socialist, I mean, what is the what tips it across that edge that constitutes socialism in your definition?
Well, you have to imagine that I wrote this book a couple of years ago,
right?
And no, since then, a lot of things have changed, right?
That was my next question, but go ahead, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Well, I mean, a couple of years ago, it felt to me like that people on the left and progressives only knew what they were against. They were against austerity, against growth, against racism, against homophobia. But there were very few people who had some kind of positive vision of where they actually wanted to go. Now, obviously, we're in a different era now, and I'm more and more hopeful about the future. You know, this whole phenomenon of AOC is just amazing to watch, and just remember here that she's not only influential and her whole movement is not only influential in America, but also in Europe. I see it changing the conversation in Holland, for example, is that suddenly politicians are willing to come up with bolder proposals to do something about poverty, to do something about inequality, and to do something about climate change. So I'm incredibly excited how the conversation is already shifting. And indeed, now the underdog socialists, you may call them the so-called moderates or the centrists, who are like, can't we just tinker a little bit around the edges? And this is all too radical for me. Well, to be honest, I think this is the time to be radical because the challenges we're facing are radical as well.
It has been stunning this progression, and I think we might be where we want to land at least, but I'm curious just because you know obviously you got some acclaim from your call for higher taxes at Davos. Of course, and then your subsequent appearance on Tucker Carlson's program. Tucker has since had, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, a couple of bad weeks since you've been on.
Yeah. Not a great time to be Tucker.
Not a great time to be Tucker. Well, he's had quite a run of it being a pretty good time to be Tucker. But this notion, I just want to get back to circle back around a little bit to the idea of you're calling for higher taxes. This is, I think, largely a function in your mind, a way to deal with inequality. You know, this story that is just broken about the extremely wealthy families who are willing to pay a huge amount of money just to get their kids into a college that I think that they felt they could say to their friends their kids are in.
Yeah,
is indicative of a dynamic. You make the point. I don't want to, end our conversation without touching on this because I think this is fascinating.
Sure.
That it is the relative poverty, or one could say the relative wealth, which is one of the primary drivers of discontent in society, and can drive people to pay $6 million. To get their kid into a university, and I would suggest that if you can afford $6 million to pay for your kid to get into university, you don't need them to get into that kind of university. They're going to be fine.
Absolutely. You know, there's an extraordinary amount of evidence from social science that inequality, if you have too much of it, which is certainly the case right now in the United States, that it becomes a social poison. It basically poisons everything. It poisons relationships between people. It poisons, you know, the institutions. People trust their fellow human beings less. They trust their institutions and their democracies less. So, yeah, that's what's been happening. And my frustration in Davos was that people were talking about inequality. I was on a panel about the cost of inequality, but no one was talking about taxes, right? So, as I said in Davos as well, I felt like being at a firefighters conference, and no one's being allowed to talk about water. Well, if you zoom out a little bit, and if you look at the past 50 years, you'll see that inequality has grown, and taxes have gone down, down, down. I mean, for the very rich, there is a connection here, right? You don't need a PhD in economics to see it. So, yeah, I've been arguing for the past couple of years that we should go back to, say, the 50s and the 60s, make America great again, and bring back those higher tax rates.
What was the reception that you got? I mean, you know, I know Davos has its own sort of fractal inequality where like the billionaires get to go get the key card and go all the way up on the elevator, and the 100 millionaires have their lounge areas. But to the extent, I mean, what was the reception that you received to the extent that you can get a sense of who you've been talking to and who's coming up to you?
Well, as you can imagine, they weren't very happy with me. It was quite an uncomfortable experience. But then again, I'm a believer in the power of ideas. So I do believe that people can be convinced. There were a lot of people, actually, who, when I announced that I was going to Davos, who were very critical of that. You know, I received a lot of emails, people saying, oh, I'm so disappointed in you. Why do you go there? This is the party of the billionaires. Don't you know that? But I believe in speaking truth to power. You know, that's also why I went on Tucker Carlson, because I think it's important to go there and not only talk to people in your own bubble, but also spread the message elsewhere. And I'm also optimistic that even the billionaires in Davos, you know, you can make them feel uncomfortable, and that in the longer run can actually help them change their mind.
All right. Lastly, let me ask you this, and I understand if you don't want to get anybody in trouble, but the Tucker Carlson thing, okay? Because I've done a lot of these type of hits, and I have a pretty good sense of what the setup is. Although I don't know where you actually shot this, but Did you record it after, or was someone recording it in real time, I guess is the question I had, behind the scenes there?
It was all in real time. So you have to imagine it was 2 a.m. in Amsterdam at that point. I was in a studio in Amsterdam. And I walked into the studio and asked the producer, like, can you record it? Do you have the equipment, the technology for that? Because I'm going to throw a hand grenade at Tucker Carlson. He's probably not going to like it, and he might not air it. And then this guy said, you know, I can't do that because I don't have the equipment for it. And I said, you know what, doesn't mind. I'm just going to say what I have to say, and we'll drink a couple of beers after that. and then I did the interview, and then this producer came walking in the room with his iPhone in his hand. So he had recorded it all with his iPhone. So that's how it happened. Then we started drinking beer for the next 2 hours. It was 4 a.m. at that point, I think. And then I went back into the cab. And it was only in the cab that I looked at the video again and thought, holy shit, this is something I have here. So, yeah, it wasn't really planned.
And I guess you had a sense as you went out for beers that they would not probably be airing that segment on Tucker's
show.
No,
well, to be honest, I still thought that he was going to air it. I don't know. Maybe I'm naive. But maybe it's also my Dutch background. We Dutch, we don't have issues with people swearing and stuff. We don't bleep anything. But you Americans are so sensitive about everything. Oh, he said bullshit. Well, who cares?
All right, we're just going to have to drop out that bullshit term. We'll fix that in post. That's really no. I'm joking. That's great. We really enjoyed it and appreciate the work you're doing. And folks should check out Utopia for Realists. We will put a link on majority.fm. How we can build the ideal world. It's a great read. And Rutger Bregman, really appreciate your time today.
Really, thanks for having me.
Bye bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. That's great. I love that story.
It's a nice little image.
Yes, it is.
Two Dutch guys getting drunk after trolling Tucker Carlson from across the Atlantic.
I wish I was there. I read a book in college called Dealing with the Dutch, which reminded me of that. That was awesome.
I also just appreciate, like, it's 2 a.m. I just did my cable television hit. Let's go have a beer for a couple hours.
Obviously beers.
Obviously.
Dealing with the Dutch, man.
All right, we're going to take a break, head into the...
You're so sensitive. We say bullshit. Who cares? Think about the Dutch, IMer from Philly.
I don't know what that... I mean.
The IMer who requested less profanity on the shows.
I don't remember that. I guess that really stuck in your craw.
Deeply.
When was that?
Actually, it was only like a couple days ago. You're really not getting enough sleep.
Michael felt attacked. He was talking about it all yesterday.
Oh, is that
all
right?
All day. I dedicated the show. TMBS last night was in defense of swearing.
There was 80 F words.
Yeah. Was there
you know
really?
What? I don't care.
That's how you'll lose your YouTube monetization. Watch that.
Gosh darn it.
For some reason, the show last night did get, like, it's like a halfway suitable for advertisers type of thing. I'm not sure why.
Joshua
and John Iderola, so it shouldn't be. But
it's the swearing.
Quite weird.
It's the swearing. Anyways. Yeah. Folks, Calm and Comfort by Sharper Image is the luxurious weighted blanket that's designed with high-density comfort fill to promote a sense of calmness for a restful night's sleep. Calm and Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, best nights of sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. And right now, our listeners can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com, use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout, receive $15 off the displayed price. Again, that's calmingcomfortblanket.com. Promo code MAJORITY, because you cannot put a price on a great night's sleep. Folks, this just in. Paul Manafort got 3.5 years sentence in his case. This was the second case that he was facing, or I should say the second set of charges in... We know the other day he got 4.5 years. This was the second set of charges that were brought to, against him in a federal district court in Washington. This judge was far less inclined to see all the good deeds that Paul Manafort had apparently done in his life.
Honorably toiled for dictators for decades.
That's
exactly.
What he said. That's what I said. That's obviously what our position is.
So he got about half of what the maximum would have been. The maximum, my understanding, would have been 10 years for the two different counts, five each. He ended up getting 3.5 years. That actually is a secondary story. Because the moment it appears that the moment that Paul Manafort was sentenced, Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance unsealed 15 fraud and conspiracy charges against Paul Manafort. So understand, these are state charges brought by the New York City District Attorney. Why is this important? Because you cannot be pardoned by the President of the United States for state charges. So if Paul Manafort had in his mind this whole time, I'm going to get pardoned, there does not appear to be any charges against me in, remember, Southern District of New York. And this is also true with the Cohen thing. And I have a feeling they probably have charges. Cy Vance probably has a whole set of charges against Cohen, too. Southern District, when you hear SDNY, the Southern District of New York, understand that is a federal office. That is the federal, essentially, local affiliate of the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice. The New York DA, as opposed, and it could have also been the state attorney general, although we had a little problem with our last one. The New York DA has a whole new set of charges that will not in any way allow for Manafort to escape the situation with a pardon, assuming he's convicted of one of these 15 fraud and conspiracy charges against Paul Manafort. And I got to say, I'm not a lawyer. I'm also not a professional gambler. But I would bet that at least one or two of those are going to stick out of that 15.
There's a certain probability of that, I would say.
So things are going to get a little... Now, The real point, it seems to me, this is obviously somewhat coordinated, right? I mean, in some fashion. How, we don't know. And I don't know what would have been considered appropriate in this context. This suggests that that Mueller or the U.S. Attorney's Office feel that Manafort has more to give. Because a pardon at this point, after he's been convicted, Donald Trump may go and pardon him, but Manafort was, he's going to go to jail. Wasn't going to help further any type of investigation into Trump. They either feel that Manafort has more to give, or that this is a message to other people associated with Trump that, like, look, we know how this is going to work. And if you were thinking you were going to wait for a pardon, you may want to think twice. So it's one of those things. It could be both of those things. They're not mutually exclusive at all. So,
you know what I respect about David Axelrod? He's not a rat. Because what you have is you have these RICO cases, and in a sense, it's really unfair. Because what they do is they flip somebody, and then they become a rat. Testify against the whole organization.
Chicago politics. All right. Well,
it's totally unfair.
We're going to take a quick break.
But I do respect that David's kept his mouth shut. I do respect. I respect that greatly in a certain sense.
We're going to take a quick break. We will talk more about this in the fun half. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Just pennies a day. Support the free show. Get the extra content every day. jointhemajorityreport.com. Today is Wednesday. Like I said at the beginning of the show, that means that last night was Tuesday. That means that things were a little bit messy when we came in this
day. Oh, were they?
No, not really. But I just needed a hook.
Go ahead. It was a great show last night. Commentary on 2020, the return of pseudo-woke politics. Joshua Kahn of the Wildfire Project, a professional organizer, gave us like a tutorial on how to run and organize campaigns. In the post game, we continued the lesson using The Simpsons. And then John Iadarola talked about how terrible Joe Biden is. Patreon.com/TMBS or subscribe on our Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel.
Jamie, the Antifada.
Yeah, so this week on the Antifada, Andy was finally back from his trip to Mexico. I was back from a much shorter trip to Mexico. And Andy actually did a number of interviews with people from the migrant caravan who were currently working at an anarchist mutual aid center in Tijuana. He got their stories in their own words, which I think is super important because a lot of the time we talk about the people in the caravan in sort of a monolithic way, like they're these like faceless suffering victims. Like, no, they are individuals with their own stories and their own agency and their own politics. And I thought that was really meaningful. He also talked to some people at a nonprofit organization called El Otro Lado that helps people with the process of applying for asylum. And yeah, I'm really stoked about this one and I'm glad that we got to do it. So check it out, patreon.com/theantifada, as well as podcast apps.
This weekend on Literary Hangover, we're doing Mary Rowlandson, Captivity Narratives, and King Philip's War. The following episode is going to be on The Soul of Man Under Socialism by Oscar Wilde with David Griscom of the TMBS, actually.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So that will be relevant to the conversation with Rutger, actually. A lot of automation and shorter work weeks and that sort of stuff in there. Is that bored dead?
Yeah, it is.
You didn't use it last night.
Well, you turned it around. Sorry. Or unplugged it.
Oh, it got unplugged?
Yeah.
To turn around? Oh, I'm sorry. I guess that was your mess.
See you in the fun half. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.